This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. My guest today is Chuck Klosterman. He has a new paperback version of his book, 10, out right now. If you don't already have the hardcover, which you should get, the hardcover looks really cool. There's like this black lining on the pages. It makes it look like a satanic Bible. It's really, really a cool looking design. But if you want to get the cheaper version, I'm sure the paperback looks awesome and it's available now and you should get that. Chuck is always a great guest. We haven't had him on the show in a while. He actually came on this episode because I had asked him a long time ago if he would write a blurb for my new book, Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. And he said, I don't know if I can do that. I'm doing a million blurbs. I'm busy, but I will go on your podcast and I will talk about your book with you if that's okay. And I was like, okay, I'm going to hold you to that. And then 6 months later, I was like, hey, remember when you said you'd come on the podcast? Like, is that offer still good? And Chuck is a man of his word. And he said, yes, he would come on. So we talked a bit about his book and we talked a lot about my book. We talked a lot about classic rock and Led Zeppelin all that stuff and how we came to this music and why we still obsess over it. And we had a really great conversation and I'm excited to get to it here. And by the way, my book came out last week. It's been out for a while, you know, a week now, 7 days, and it's exciting. You know, the reaction to it has been really great. It's gotten really good reviews. I've been hearing from readers on Twitter who have checked out the book. And that's always really gratifying, you know, to see people getting into it and getting something out of it. You know, it takes a long time to get a book going. You know, you have to sell a book and then you have to go into a room with a computer and try to figure it out. But then if you're lucky, you're able to finish it and it comes out. And this is really the best part, you know, where the book exists and you can just talk to people about it. It has its own life in the world, you know, it's just out there. Your kid, your little book child that you've created. It was really fun to talk about it with Chuck. I think we had a really great conversation and I think you guys are all going to dig it. So without further ado, here is me and Chuck Klosterman talking about 10 and Twilight of the Gods. All right. So the paperback version of it's Chuck Klosterman. Chuck Klosterman 10, not X, right?
Yeah, you know, it is 10. It was stupid of me to put the X on there in a way. And the reason it's so stupid is because this is the second time I've now done this.
Right. Well, it's like you're like Chicago, you know? Chicago put out like 14 albums that had Roman numerals, I think.
Yeah, but because they did it every time, people knew what they were doing. Also, you know, my fourth book, you know, Chuck Klosterman 4, that was an anthology, and people thought that was like called IV or whatever, like it was a medical textbook. I don't know why I thought that they wouldn't be more confused by an actual letter. I overlooked the interest in Roman numerals by the population at large.
See, the IV thing, I don't understand. I think that was clearly 4, and I understand it's the classic rock thing, Led Zeppelin 4, all that stuff. I think I did call your book X at one point, though.
Most people do, and I can't really complain about it. And it's not the worst thing, because X is at least like a, you know, has other meanings as an English letter. You know, it's like has a math element and it has a sexual element and all these things. So it's not the worst thing.
But. Yeah, it sounds cool either way. I think, you know, IV doesn't sound good, but X or 10 sounds good. Do you feel like this is a milestone? I mean, 10 books, that's a lot of books.
I guess. More than 9.
More than 9. Are you working on something right now?
Yes. Are we recording or not?
We are recording, so
okay,
we'll just keep it under wraps. Okay.
Okay, sure.
Top secret project. Do you expect that to be announced anytime soon?
I don't know. It'll come out next year.
Okay. Less said about that, the better for now. So this is a good transition from talking about your book to my book, which is you included the profile of Jimmy Page that you did. I guess that was that for GQ?
Yes.
Which is a profile I love, even though it's clear that Jimmy Page is not someone who's really open to being profiled. And there's a bunch of really great profiles in your book of people who seem sort of similar in that regard, who don't seem like they're very open people, and yet you're able to write about them in an evocative way, thinking about like Tom Brady or Taylor Swift. When you're in a situation like that, do you find that you have to lean on your own impressions of these people more than you would for quotes or anything like that?
No, I think that when someone is reticent to speak, the quotes become more important, paradoxically. I mean, if you're talking to somebody who loves being interviewed, if you're talking to Bono or whatever, somebody who almost sees the reporter as a kind of therapist, well, there's almost this built-in understanding that what they're saying has been unconsciously rehearsed.
Right.
And that they are pretty complicit in the shaping of how they are viewed. But with someone like Jimmy Page, who came from a period where artists in general, but his band more than any, did not view media as remotely essential or even helpful in the kind of their career trajectory, who only sort of sees it as a negative thing, like the way the bands act in Almost Famous or whatever, like that just, I've never had that kind of experience with a contemporary band.
Right.
But it's sort of based on the way a band like Led Zeppelin was. So he knew me as clearly as an adversarial aspect, which is so weird because it's like, I mean, it's not weird. I understand his perspective, but like, the degree that I like Led Zeppelin is pretty, you know, deep. So it's like I'm really kind of on his side, but because I like that music so much and I've thought about that band so much, there were things that I would want to ask him that I feel have never been addressed before. You know, I'm sure I haven't read everything that's ever been written about Led Zeppelin, but I've read a lot of it, and there were still some things I just kind of wanted to know. And he sees that in a very different way. His idea is that, well, I'm putting out these box sets of all our records, and the music stands on its own. I really want to talk about the microphones I used when I recorded it.
Right.
And, like, that's what he wants to talk about, and that's his prerogative. It's just, you know, you can't say to somebody, I want to interview you, but you got to be interested in what I'm interested in.
Right.
So then there's this tension of me trying to ask him questions he doesn't want to talk about, and him wanting to talk about, say, the history of magnetic recording tape after World War II.
Is there a particular question that you wanted to ask that you weren't able to ask him, or that you asked and he didn't really want to answer?
Well, he had given one interview where he had mentioned that, you know, drugs were central to some of the creation of his music. He's like, I'm not going to deny this, that they were. So my thing was, which recordings? Like, what is there music in their catalog that directly came from his use of heroin or from his use of cocaine that he suspects would not, that the song either wouldn't exist or would be different if that hadn't been part of it. And he was not really into that question. And it was a 2-day interview, and that happened probably 20 minutes into the first day. And it was kind of weird from that point on. The second day, he was a little better. He was, you know, and I was a little more aware that I got to be sort of careful about this. The one thing that everybody it mentions about this profile is I asked these two questions in the end, one about David Coverdale,
right,
and sort of one about the occult, and they think that like it was a real uncomfortable thing or a real offensive thing. Certainly the question about David Coverdale he thought was funny. Like, I could tell he thought it was funny, but that he didn't laugh and he didn't give a funny response.
Well, and the question was, like, did he make the Coverdale Page record to annoy Robert Plant?
Yes, yeah.
which is a very funny question.
I was interested in what he would say, and he was just like that. You know, but I could, you know, you can sometimes tell things in person that you can't tell on the page, and that's just part of it. And that's part of the downside to working in a, you know, medium that's, you know, in a lot of ways one or two dimensional. But, you know, it's, I mean, if you were, are there things about Led Zeppelin you would still like to ask Jimmy Page?
Well, I recently interviewed Robert Plant for my podcast, and with Robert Plant, he is very, you read any interview with Robert Plant, it's clear that he's not really interested in talking about Led Zeppelin stuff. You kind of have to go mm-hmm. in a, sort of a roundabout way. And we did talk a little bit about Led Zeppelin 4, and I got into that through talking about British folk music, you know, and Sandy Denny being on the Battle of Evermore. And that was sort of a backdoor into talking about Led Zeppelin 4. If I had just said, hey, what was memorable about making Led Zeppelin 4, he would have shut me down immediately. Or if I had asked about the Mud Shark incident or something, like he would have shut me down or hung up the phone. So, I mean, there would have been lots of things I would have wanted to ask him, but I only had a half hour. So it was more about just trying to keep him on, you know, on the phone for that long.
Yeah, I had interviewed Robert Plant in 2002 when I was at Spin. We did a metal issue. It was all about heavy metal. Axl Rose was on the cover, you know, and a shot from him from like 1989 or whatever. And I did a Q&A with Plant. So Plant, he knew that we were just going to ask him about metal and heavy metal music, which is a genre he has zero interest in.
Right.
So, that whole thing was kind of interesting. You know, it's like he, the guys in Zeppelin are interesting. Like, they're friends with the members of Black Sabbath, but they don't think the music is good.
Right.
Like they, John Bonham used to call that kind of music, I think it was something like Deep Purple or Black, he just thought the whole genre was kind of dumb sounding, you know. Or you talk about bands from the 80s, all of whom, all those metal bands, those LA bands who are all you know, influenced by Led Zeppelin, like they don't like any of those groups. They kind of like Rush. That's about it. That's the only one of those groups that they find remotely interesting. It's
right.
A strange deal.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And, you know, and I think Robert Plant talked about, like, having a vacation with Geddy Lee or something, and that they ran into each other at a vacation.
At a hotel.
At a hotel, yeah. Had a good time. You know, you and I, we're around the same age. I think you're a little bit older than I am, but, you know, we both grew up after Led Zeppelin had already broken up. So, you know, we weren't coming at the music from the boomer perspective where we grew up with these records as they were coming out. And in my book, I'm writing about classic rock from that perspective, from the perspective of, I guess, Gen Xers and maybe even millennials who come to this music through classic rock radio and how that affects how they look at the music. And I'm just curious, like, you know, how old were you when you had your first Zeppelin phase, and was it through classic rock radio, and how did that influence your view of the band?
Yeah, well, it's a little odd, and it does, I think that my experience in some ways reflects a lot of the ideas in your book, because, okay, so I get into music real seriously in 1983 or 84, during that period, 85, and at that time, Led Zeppelin seemed super old to me. Like, it seemed like my older brother's music. It didn't seem competitive, as insane as that sounds. Like, it didn't seem competitive with the music I was into at the time. So I had very little interest. Then one of my friends kind of started getting into more kind of progressive music in general, like starting with like Queensryche and then getting into maybe Rush or something and then getting into Led Zeppelin. So I had Led Zeppelin 4 on CD, right when CDs were new. This was like 1989. So I liked Led Zeppelin 4. I probably had it on cassette too. I liked the song Rock and Roll the most, I suppose. But I didn't, it wasn't important to me until I got to college. And then at college, for some reason, I kind of moved in this direction where it seemed like Led Zeppelin was the only good band there was for a while. It's like it seemed like every other band seemed lesser to me for about 9 months. It had to have been around the time, I think, when that first box set came out. I had initially thought that Robert Plant, when I was younger, I didn't really like his vocal style.
Right.
Then I kind of came to conclude he was the best vocalist. Then years later, I remember I interviewed Steve Albini. This is before he did the Coverdale Page record. And he pretty much said Robert Plant was the worst vocalist working.
Right.
But then he must have been, I don't know if he was lying to me or if he did the record because he thought it would be funny or if he, I don't know. So I've seen every possible description of his singing, but yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, do you feel, because like for me, you know, we're talking about, you know, interviewing these people, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, like what we'd want to ask them. I feel like one of the big things with Led Zeppelin and a lot of the classic rock bands is this idea of mystique, that they didn't want to reveal too much because there was something about the music that was sort of inherently mysterious. The way they presented it was often, had a lot of ambiguity to it. And I feel like he's right to think that. Like, because when I was getting ready to interview Robert Plant, there, I naturally have things that I'm interested in just as like a music writer that I'd want to ask him. But there's also things like I didn't want to know about them. And there was a mythology to that band that I almost didn't want to have dispelled that I got from like Hammer of the Gods and just reading that book and all the legends that come out of there. Was that something that ever meant anything to you? Like that sort of idea that there was a sort of a mystery to that kind of music that that drew you in?
Well, okay, it's possible, but my answer would be if it happened, it was unconscious.
Right.
And here's why I say this. I don't think it's possible, or maybe a better word, I don't think it's normal to be into the mystique of something if you view what you don't know as mystique.
Okay.
In other words, if you look at the thing and you say, like, I don't know about this, that's interesting, that's a weird way to think about it, okay? I think an example of this was the band Tool, okay? Like, Tool was immediately kind of this interesting thing because you were like, I wonder what those guys are like, sort of, you know? It's like the videos are so bizarre and, like, do they like a band like Black Sabbath, or do they think it's dumb? Like, are they all these things, you know? And then all of a sudden, the story became framed about Tool. We know nothing about them. They're mysterious. They don't give these interviews. And then it was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess that's the thing. That's the thing, man. They're doing. They don't want attention. You know, like to me, mystique happens when you believe that you're understanding things about the group, and there are questions in your mind that no one told you is something you're not supposed to know. Like, you know, if you were a fan of Led Zeppelin in the 70s, because the example often used that, you know, if you didn't see a picture of Jimmy Page, you know, in a magazine, or you didn't go see him when they came to your town or whatever, that's it. You just had the records. You know, there was no MTV. They weren't, you know, but I mean, how would they have not been mysterious? Like, Rolling Stone wasn't interested in them. A daily newspaper in 1977 in Omaha is not going to be like, let's do a think piece on the new Zeppelin record. I mean,
right.
Like, you know, they could have said, well, we want to be in Cream or Tiger Beach or whatever, you know. But in some ways, they had mystique because there was, well, what else was going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I do wonder, though, that if there's a certain kind of person that is attracted to this music 20 or 30 years after the fact and making a conscious decision that I'm going to listen to this versus some other artist that is maybe way more accessible that I can find out way more about. You know, because, like, I mean, in one of your books, you wrote this thing that I think is very true, which is that, like, every young person and particularly men, they go through a Zeppelin phase at some point where they believe that this is like the best music of all time, and it's a very intense period, and that seems like a pretty common experience. And you would think that, well, maybe that doesn't happen anymore. And then I don't know if you've heard this band. There's like a young band called Greta Van Fleet.
Oh yeah, of course.
Who you know, they've become like a pretty big band. They're playing sold out shows everywhere. They don't really get covered by like the like cool sort of indie music websites, but they get played on the radio. There seems to be a lot of buzz with them. They sound exactly like Led Zeppelin, and they're all like 20 years old. And so they were born in what, like 1998 or so. So it seems like there's still that phase that at least some people are going through with this band. I'm curious, like, why do you think that is?
Well, okay, there's a couple things here. One, which can't be overlooked, is that however you define the music that Led Zeppelin played, whatever, like, however you want to look at that, that was the best version of that music. I mean, they were all four guys in the band were sort of at the apex of whatever category they would be in. And so if you look at that as sort of like kind of just straight hard rock, if you look at it as blues-based rock performed by white British people, if you look at it as like sort of the like a really, really mainstream version of metal, however you want to see it, you know, it's like whatever category you use, they're the best at that. So that's part of it. Another thing that, like, I don't know if this still happens, though, because the internet probably has changed this, but one thing that's always interesting to me is I remember getting the Motley Crue record Too Fast for Love, okay, yeah. And looking at the cover of that record, okay, and thinking, like, this is kind of a provocative, interesting cover. It's like, what the fuck, you know? Of course, I had not ever seen the Stones record that looks exactly like that.
Right.
You know, I didn't have that, you know? So this thing that was a copy was still new to me. Like, it was the effect that the Motley Crue record had was the same as the effect, you know, Sticky Fingers would have had or whatever. So maybe when some people are hearing Greta Van Fleet, the things that they would have liked about Led Zeppelin, they're liking about this band. Now, the weird thing about this is I think it's much more likely that a 15-year-old kid who likes music will have heard Led Zeppelin in totality and would have heard Sticky Fingers and all these things first, because that music is so accessible now, and it doesn't require the financial investment that sort of limited how much you could know about music when you were a teenager.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're like, you're 40, what, 1 or 42?
Yeah, I'm 40.
40, okay. So I don't know how much disposable income you had when you were 14, but I'm guessing that there was a pretty, you know, hard ceiling.
Right.
On what old records you could buy simply for the knowledge.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, that to me is the biggest thing that has, like, my relationship with Spotify. I know there's all these problems with Spotify, you know, and people have all these business issues and then, you know, aesthetic and ideological things. I mean, the thing that Spotify is allowing me to do is to listen to records that I would never have ever possibly purchased or even wanted to purchase, because I know I'm only listening them to see what they are, and that's it. You
right.
know? And that's something that we could not do growing up.
Right. And it's created this thing, like, where music, no genre of music really ever has to die now. Like, there's not that phenomenon where, you know, hair metal is in trend for a while and then grunge comes along and, like, you can't see hair metal videos on MTV anymore, and therefore it's really hard to see those videos anywhere. If you're into hair metal, you can always like hair metal, or you can always like any kind of music regardless of whether it's in fashion. And I guess that's also true of classic rock too. But I'm curious, you know, like, in my book, one of the things I'm talking about is that this generation of classic rock musicians is approaching the point where they're either retiring, or many of them are passing away, or they've already died in recent years. And I feel like that's going to have an impact on how that music is perceived and heard, or even how much people care about it. Because now we're at a point still, like, where a lot of these bands do have a fairly high profile, certainly as concert attractions. Like, they are in many ways like the most important part of the concert industry, some of these older classic rock bands, you know, whether it's Springsteen or Guns N' Roses or U2 or whoever it might be. Do you think it's going to make a difference when you can't actually see these people live in terms of, like, keeping the music alive, or does it not matter because it's on Spotify?
I don't think that will matter as much because, I mean, the thing, okay, say a band like Foreigner, for example, okay? So Foreigner's touring for the most part with no original members. There's not one original person in the band.
Yeah.
People are going to those shows. But part of it has to do with the fact that there is now something that didn't exist before, which is like a 60-year-old person whose only relationship to music is rock music. You know, so if they want to experience this thing that is really the only musical relationship they've had, maybe the only relationship to art they've had, they're going to go to the clubs to see, or the theaters to see these bands, even if they weren't huge Foreigner fans at the time. Like, they may have just been sort of the kind of person who listened to the radio and Foreigner songs were always on, and they're like, well, this is music, I know these songs, or whatever. So I don't really think that's keeping Foreigner's memory alive. I don't think it would matter if Foreigner stopped touring. I don't think if that incarnation of the band stopped touring, I don't think their sort of the space they occupy would really be changed that much. The dying thing is a bigger deal. I mean, certainly, you know, if all the members of Soundgarden live to be 90, that would have been very different. Their memory is going to be much more implanted on people because they had someone in the band die early, and it kind of briefly reintroduced that music to a lot of people and put people in this position where, because of the nature of celebrity death now, they wanted to express an affinity about them that may have never existed. So that is part of it. I mean, you know, it's interesting to see who's living and who's not, you know. That's really...
To me, it's just what's interesting about classic rock, I think, versus a lot of other kinds of music that you could mention. And again, before we get to that, because I talk about this in the book, I try to define what classic rock is, because there's a lot of different definitions of that. I kind of hew to what I heard on the radio as a kid, because I feel, because again, classic rock was invented as a radio format. That's how the term came into being, and then it became something else in the popular consciousness. But like when that term is used, or when you use it, what are you referring to?
Well, you know, I to me, it. If someone's talking about classic rock, I guess, or when I say someone is a classic rock band, I guess sort of using the original radio designation, to be honest.
Right.
Like radio designations are just interesting in general. I mean, like the idea of oldies.
Right. Okay?
Well, music from the 70s is old now, but they're not oldies,
right?
You know?
Although they are in some formats now. Like now, it's been changed. But like, yeah, in the classic, like in the way that you and I would think about it, I think we're thinking of like early, like late 50s, early 60s type stuff.
If you listen to an oldies station that let's kind of calls itself like solid gold oldies or whatever, unless that they're just using the term and they don't really give a shit. I mean, they're pretty much stopping with the first Beatles singles. That's about as late as they're going to go.
Right.
Now, classic rock, as you've noted, is this ever-expanding thing where at one point it was like, well, they're going to let some 80s artists in. They're going to let Appetite for Destruction in and some of that. And then it was like, well, Pearl Jam makes sense. They actually sound like some of these bands, but not Nirvana. But then Nirvana did get put in.
Right.
Now, the one thing that intrigued me about your book that I wanted to ask you about is that you select Nine Inch Nails' The Fragile as the end of classic rock. And I would have never come to that conclusion on my own, but especially the way you describe it makes total sense to me. I think actually that's a very sort of good way to say this is when that ended. I'm wondering, were there any other records that you considered to see as the bookend for when classic rock stops?
Yeah, there was one, and before I say what that is, I just want to explain my reasoning with The Fragile, because that record came out at the end of 1999, where 1999 matters because that's the year that Napster became a really big deal. That's when people were going online to download music illegally, and they were kind of getting trained that this was going to be the new place that you were going to hear about records, and that influenced how people listened to music, that you were still downloading albums, but this idea that you didn't have to get a record to hear a song that you liked, that's when that really kind of dawned on people that this was going to be a possibility. So this idea of an album, which is central to, you know, the story of classic rock, that being kind of the center of what music is going to be, that started to go away. And obviously albums still matter 20 years after that, but it's changed the significance of that. So The Fragile seemed like a good example, a good signifier of that, because it was a record made in very much a classic rock style. You know, Trent Reznor was working with Bob Ezrin, who did The Wall. He did all those Alice Cooper records. To sequence the record,
but you're clearly making an ideological sort of stopping point, because if there, okay, right now there's a guy outside of my house. He's doing some construction labor on his on my kid's playground. He's fixing the kid's play structure, right? And he has a radio out there, and he's talking to me, and he says he likes classic rock. That's what he listens to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think if I played him The Fragile, he would be fucking annoyed by it, right?
Right, right, right.
Not, like a guy, if someone says I listen to classic rock, they don't probably listen to that, but from the kind of a constructive standpoint, I think it does make sense. I was wondering if maybe the other candidates you had were records where you say, like, well, musically, this seems to be when classic rock ends, because it is hard, because classic rock is kind of whatever you say it is if it's on the radio.
Well, and I almost thought about talking about, like, Is This It, the Strokes record, because I feel like those early 2000s bands were sort of the last generation of bands that the media talked about in a way where they felt there was a genuine feeling that those bands were going to take over pop culture, that they were going to take over pop music in the same way that, like, the grunge bands took over popular music 10 years earlier. And I think there was a real wish that that was going to happen. And it didn't happen, you know, and ever since then, there's really never been a belief that rock bands had that kind of cachet anymore. So if it wasn't going to be The Fragile, I think you could make an argument there, because when you talk to younger people now who weren't alive at the time, they do look at The Strokes as a classic rock band. You know, they look at Julian Casablancas as almost like a Lou Reed type eccentric person.
Okay, but here's the semantic thing you point out. Do they look at The Strokes as a classic rock band, or do they think of them as a classic rock band?
Well,
I do think they see them as a classic rock band. It's like, oh, they're from New York and they all wear the same kind of jackets and their haircuts are the same. I mean, I don't, it would be like, if I put on the classic rock station on Sirius Radio, I would be pretty surprised to hear a Strokes record, even though that probably will happen at some point.
Right.
I mean, I think that your starting point, your inception point is Sgt. Pepper. And I think that that would be the consensus. That
right.
would be that most people would say this is where classic rock kind of begins, because also on traditional classic rock radio, you don't hear a ton of the Beatles, but nothing from prior to that. Like,
totally.
Like Abbey Road songs will get in there more than anything else. But in some ways, I kind of think the end of classic rock as a sound may have been Appetite for Destruction. And the reason I say that is because when the guys in Guns N' Roses would be interviewed about, like, what bands they liked, they would say Aerosmith and AC/DC and, like, then Queen and Elton John. They would say these, they would say they like punk rock, and then they would say these classic rock artists. And they're not lying. It's true. Alice Cooper and all these things.
Right.
But the music they were playing sounded different. You could see that they were influenced by Thin Lizzy, but it didn't sound like Thin Lizzy. So I sort of view that it's like from 67 to 87, like 20 years, that's the music of classic rock, but it doesn't include every artist in that section. Here was something else I wanted to ask you about. Okay, I want to just name a few artists, and I want you to say if they're classic rock from your view.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So are Joni Mitchell records from the 70s classic rock?
See, I would call her classic rock, yeah. Even though it doesn't really seem like dyed-in-the-wool rock music, I feel like she's part of that history, maybe just by virtue of her association with the singer-songwriter movement of the 70s and, you know, the Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young people and all that. So I would put her in there. I'm guessing
okay.
You would not.
Are the Clash classic rock?
Yes.
Absolutely, no question.
Yeah, I think absolutely, especially like combat rock. I think that was, they officially got, you know, absorbed at that point. You know, Rock the Casbah, Should I Stay or Should I Go? I would put them in for sure.
Okay, Slayer classic rock.
No.
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 Why not?
Well, I would lean on the radio definition. I mean, I don't know if Slayer's ever been on the radio in any type They never had a single or song or anything, and I don't really hear them connected to anything classic rocky except maybe Black Sabbath, but that seems like a fairly tenuous connection, just because I think of Sabbath being kind of slow and heavy, and Slayer being like fast and, you know, more metallic.
Okay, so like a band like the Slits, a punk band like that, who weren't on the radio, they're not classic rock.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I get into this in the book talking about Lou Reed and David Bowie, and maybe I have to go back on the Joni Mitchell. That's a good question. Like, do you for all those people you just mentioned, where do you put them?
I would say Joni Mitchell is not really classic rock, because I don't know if I feel like she plays rock, you know?
Right.
But that's not the only, I mean, like Bob Dylan doesn't really play rock, but rock people think that he does, so he's sort of in there. To me, Slayer is not classic rock. The Clash, in a sense, were the sort of adversarial idea to classic rock, but like Train in Vain is on classic rock all the time. So they ended up having some songs go in there. And it's almost like if you have one song in that kind of, you know, unilateral collection or whatever, you're in, you know?
Right. Well, I get into this in the book, because there's like certain artists that seem superficially similar, that, and you can make these lines where one is classic rock and one isn't. Like Billy Joel, I think, is like clearly classic rock. He's like one of the artists you will hear on any classic rock station. But someone like Randy Newman, for instance, I would call him more of like a cult artist. He doesn't really seem like a classic rock guy to me.
Well, and your point sort of is that you become classic rock when you become popular, and
right.
That's not untrue. I mean, like, although, okay, so, I mean, there are certain clearly classic rock bands who aren't popular, like Cactus or whatever, okay? Like, they weren't a big, huge band, but you would, if you were putting them, if the Columbia Music House still existed, and there were the little categories, which is how, in many ways, my understanding of genres is kind of built around.
Right.
Was like when you used to be in record and tape clubs, because they would sort of do it for you. The other thing I always think is, like, a band fits in a genre if the fans of that genre believe that they should be there. Like,
right.
You know, you would get into arguments in the 80s about metal. It's like, well, how can Poison be metal along with Metallica? How does that make sense, you know? And my thing was, like, they were in the same magazines.
Right.
It's like if you were buying a magazine to read about Metallica, there was going to be an article about Poison in there, and probably, you know. So that it was it had the meaning was just to a degree arbitrary, but once the arbitrary decision was made, it kind of calcified.
See, like one thing I go to in the book is talking about David Bowie and Lou Reed, because like where I grew up, the classic rock station I grew up listening to, it played pretty much, like, it was almost like a survey of David Bowie's career, like, from Space Oddity up through, say, like, Modern Love. You would hear, like, Bowie songs from almost every era in between there. Whereas with Lou Reed, it was only Walk on the Wild Side, and that was it. And maybe if I lived in New York, maybe those classic rock stations played more Lou Reed, you know, but there was no Lou Reed, no Velvet Underground. And I was aware of them because I was reading music criticism, but Lou Reed to me still doesn't seem quite like classic rock in the way that David Bowie does. Although I know when David Bowie died, people were almost offended when he was described as classic rock.
Well, here's something else I wanted to ask you about relating to this book. I always find it fascinating how the appreciation of certain kinds of music has different levels of positivity or kind of pejorative undercurrents. They're just kind of built in. For example, like, if you are really into pop punk, or if you like power pop, people will often sort of say that just mildly sheepishly, like, oh, you know, I just sort of, I'm kind of a sucker for a good pop song. You know, the bands that I like, I tend to like the single or whatever. It's sort of something to be somewhat embarrassed about. However, if you go all the way and you like just the most unabashed pop music, if like you're into like just, you know, Katy Perry and what's on the radio and all that, there's like almost this idea that you're supposed to proclaim that with no degree of regret. Like, you're almost supposed to be proud of the fact that you see through all the lies and you're getting down to like the, you know, the reality of the music. Now with classic rock, as time has moved on, it has sort of kind of, the pendulum has swung back. Okay, first when classic rock was new, I remember there was a cover of Spin with Dave Grohl on the cover, and it said classic rock on it. This was like in the 90s, you know, and it, when he was in Foo Fighters. And it was seen like, ah, who's into that? And then there was a period where it was like, oh, actually, that's where all the good bands are. If you're smart about this, you're into classic rock. And now it's back the other way. And at times I sense in your book that you feel as though there's almost an obligation for you to feel kind of bad about loving this music. And I'm wondering why that is.
See, I don't feel that way consciously. If that's something you see in the book, that's really interesting to me. Because I feel like the book is an affectionate critique, you know.
Sure.
At some point, like,
there's no question that this is music you love, but okay, I'm looking at page 289.
Yes.
You use sentences like, "What can I say? You know, when I was a kid, classic rock was a fantasy land. No matter how many depressing classic rock shows I must sit through.
Right.
Nevertheless, I will keep going." You know, it's like, while the content of the book illustrates that you love this music,
right.
This is why I say I wonder if you felt an obligation that because of the shifts in the culture, that you feel that as a white guy who's 40, you need to somehow recognize that some people think this music is bad. And I know how this is. I mean, when I wrote Fargo Rock City and I was talking about 80s metal, that is considered the most positive book, certainly at the time. It was considered the most positive book ever written about hair metal. And yet the amount of jokes I make at the expense of hair metal bands probably outweighs the compliments, you know? So I'm wondering if you thought to yourself as you were writing this, there is something odd. There was recently a book on prog rock, and you see some of that in that, too, where there is just this, we're like been socially conditioned to sort of distance ourselves from saying it's good, and you know what, it's just good.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you write about classic rock in 2018, if you don't acknowledge some of the retrograde aspects of it, you're either delusional or you're not doing your job. And I feel like just because I acknowledge those things, I feel like it's possible to like love something and acknowledge the faults at the same time. Like, I think towards the end of the book, I say something like, classic rock is my country, you know, and I love it in spite of all of the things that might be cheesy about it or problematic about it. And I mean, this is something I want to ask you about because I feel like I'm kind of surprised this hasn't happened more, although it happened a little bit like when David Bowie died. Like when David Bowie died, people talked about his past and some of his relationships with women, dealing with, especially like with underage girls, which is definitely something you see in a lot of the backstories for classic rock people, Jimmy Page being one of them, and you could mention others, where they're doing things that were maybe either accepted in the 70s or people looked the other way, and now we see them and we're horrified by it because it's behavior that if a modern superstar were doing it and we saw them doing it, they'd be swiftly condemned and with good reason. But at the same time, I still really love the music of Led Zeppelin. I don't want to toss it out, or I love David Bowie's music. I don't want to stop listening to it necessarily just because of these things happening. But I feel like to not acknowledge it would be weird. You know what I mean? Like I feel like, you know, to write about this stuff in the era of Me Too, for instance, and not acknowledge that, like, wow, these guys were doing things that I thought was awesome when I was younger, but now I'm older and maybe a little bit smarter, and I don't think it's awesome anymore. Like the stuff I read about in Hammer of the Gods that I just sort of accepted as great mythology. And I think that's what I talk about in maybe more of like a critical way. And it's just trying to talk about that stuff and integrate it into the story of the music, but also loving the music at the same time, trying to kind of nuance that, I guess.
Well, okay, well, it's particularly tricky due to the space the classic rock artists are now in, which is that they are, for the most part, still living old Caucasian guys, right? I have a feeling if someone wrote a book, a similar book to this, about jazz and the period of jazz, they would not, you know, where it was the most important music in the country. There would be much less pressure to sort of make sure that you recognize that there were some jazz artists who did problematic things, particularly if placed in the contemporary era. Okay?
Right.
Classic rock is really in the like, at this, like, it might be different, in fact, in 25 years. Like, it might, in 25, like, okay, so we started this conversation talking about, like, Jimmy Page, okay? So, like, John Bonham is in that band, okay?
Yeah.
John Bonham, as far as I can tell, is both the greatest rock drummer of all time and maybe one of the worst people. There is a, oral history Mick Wall had done about Zeppelin, and one guy talks about how one thing that John Bonham did that he thought was real hilarious is he would offer someone cocaine, but it would actually be heroin. And he said, like, John Bonham thought this hilarious, that
yeah.
he might kill a guy, okay?
Right.
Like, now, so let's say we hear about that happening now, okay? Let's say that we hear that the drummer from Greta Van Fleet has been giving people heroin when they thought he was giving, you know, like, okay, I don't know what would happen. Now, that's not even the kind of transgression that bothers people the most, because it's not like a kind of a sexual power based thing. It's just weird, you know. I don't find that people often criticize the behavior of John Bonham these days. They criticize the behavior of Jimmy Page more,
right?
Because he's alive.
Well, don't you think it's also because he's more famous in the band too? Like, I feel like John Bonham is maybe known to Led Zeppelin people, but Jimmy Page is—he's basically the front man in a way of Led Zeppelin.
He is, although I would say, you know, okay, we're also in this period where, mostly because of Twitter, there is an actual culture based around not knowing things. Okay, you know, Kanye makes a record with Paul McCartney, and BuzzFeed runs a listicle of 40 kids saying who's Paul McCartney or whatever. So there is some sort of kind of cachet about not knowing about the past. That's maybe one of the biggest, probably the biggest intellectual change in my lifetime is the fact that we've moved from this period where knowing about the past meant you were smart, and now knowing about the past kind of means like you're irrelevant almost. But if someone knows who Jimmy Page is, at this point, I think there's a high likelihood they also know who John Bonham is.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they either don't know any of the guys or they know all of them. It's not like Jimmy Page is that present in the culture.
I mean, we're hitting upon an interesting issue here, because when I wrote this book, and this may still happen, I mean, I did feel a little anxiety about how would this book be read. Is it going to be read as me glamorizing classic rock musicians and excusing picadillos, you know, because we are definitely in an era where the discussion about whether the artist should be separate from the art, it seems like that's been resolved. Like, I feel like even 5 years ago, there were people who would argue that if it's a bad person and they make a great record, I'm just going to write about the record and that's what matters to me. But now, you know, you mentioned Kanye West, who is, you know, probably the greatest rock star or rap star of the 21st century, certainly probably the most compelling. Like, he feels the most like a John Lennon figure, or, you know, like a Keith Richards type figure, you know, from classic rock history. I mean, he's in the process now of whatever it is, a meltdown on Twitter or whatever, of, you know, seeming to align himself with the alt-right. He's been very outspoken, seems to be supporting Donald Trump. That's inevitably going to influence how his record is written about. I would imagine that unless his record is amazing, that it's going to get crushed by critics who are already against him because of how he's been acting. And I just wonder if that's also going to be applied to musicians more and more of the past. If we're going to, you know, if it's going to be hard to separate that.
We're talking about many things at once, like, was it going to impact how they're written about? Oh, totally. Absolutely. I mean, okay, one thing that was interesting during all this kind of Kanye West stuff is that, like, I saw some story. It was like, Kanye West has lost 9 million followers on Twitter. And then, you know, I was like, oh, he has? That's interesting to me. Well, it turns out that he had 27 million followers before this started. And I believe he still has about 27 million followers.
Right.
Like, he lost some, but he also gained some. The thing is, a lot of these things are not that much of interest or meaning to the world at large because they never took Kanye West as seriously as writers did. I mean, this is a big part of this. I mean, it's like people spent a lot of time and invested a lot of energy into saying that Kanye West is an incredibly meaningful figure in the culture. So now when this happens, they have to reconcile this. It's like all the time I spent saying that how important this guy was, you know, and how, now he has this kind of problematic situation. How do I deal with that? And it is going, and the way they're going to deal with it is by saying that his next record is horrible.
Well, Chuck, I've kept you longer than I said I would, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much. Bye, Chuck Klosterman 10 or X, whatever you want to call it. It's on paperback now. I appreciate you coming on and talking about my book, man, and hope to have you on again soon, man.
Okay.
All right, Chuck. Take care. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
All right, that was me and Chuck getting into the book, Twilight of the Gods. That was really fun. I'm really glad that he came on. It was a great way to talk to him. I'm not sure how many book events I'm going to be doing in conjunction with this book. I am going to be at Majors & Quinn here in Minneapolis on May 30th. As of now, that's the only sort of in-person book event that I'm doing. So this podcast, it's sort of like my version of a book event, but in a podcast form. So if I can't come to your town to talk about the book, maybe just listen to this podcast in a bookstore and pretend that me and Chuck Klosterman are talking about it. For now, that's the best I can do. But, you know, I think that's a pretty good thing. Guys, thanks again for listening and supporting the podcast. As always, I got to give a shout out to Derek Madden, the producer, the man who makes it all happen, and to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. Thank you so much, guys. All right, guys, thanks again for listening to this episode of Celebration Rock. We will talk to you again next week.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.